the headlines this hour. The Syrian military says it has intercepted several Israeli missiles fired towards Damascus countryside. The Yemeni army takes control of more areas in Ma'arif and is pushed to liberate the oil-rich province from Saudi-backed militants. And the Arab League says it is concerned about the deterioration of ties between Persian Gulf Arab states and Lebanon, following a Lebanese minister's remarks about the war in Yemen. Thanks for joining us. Syria says its air defenses have intercepted Israeli missiles targeted at sites in the countryside around the capital Damascus and has downed some of them. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali tells us more about the attack.
It has been confirmed that it was an Israeli attack that hit Damascus countryside at 11:17 a.m. Local time, according to an official military source. Israel launched an attack using surface-to-surface, ground-to-ground missiles, firing them from the northern parts of the occupied Palestinian territories on Damascus countryside. According to the official military source, Syria's air defenses were able to intercept the enemy missiles, shoot down some of them. However, other missiles seem to have hit their targets, and the attack led to the injury of two Syrian army soldiers and also caused some material damage.
The Yemeni army has made further advances in Ma'arif province, taking control of a military camp near the provincial capital. Yemeni forces captured the Rish camp after fierce clashes with Saudi-backed militants. The camp is located in the Juba district south of Ma'arif province. The Yemeni army also gained control over the Jarsha district. These are the latest in a series of gains the Yemeni army has made in recent days. Ma'arif has turned into a focus of the Yemeni army operations. It is the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces. Abdel Latif al-Washali says the Yemeni army has targeted the Rish military camp with ballistic missiles before capturing it.
The Yemeni army managed this morning to take control of Rish military camp. It's a strategic camp, and it was very important to the Saudi-led coalition's forces. The Yemeni army has actually targeted this military camp with several times with ballistic missiles. It's a very important military camp as it overlooks the city of Ma'arif. It's almost on the borders of Al Juba districts. It is a major victory for the Yemeni army to take control of this camp.
The Arab League has expressed deep concerns about the worsening of ties between Persian Gulf Arab states and Lebanon. The Secretary General of the organization has urged those nations to avoid further measures that will negatively affect the Lebanese ailing economy. Ahmad Abu Ghaid has also called on Lebanese leaders to act quickly to ease the diplomatic crisis. Criticism by the Lebanese Information Minister of Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen has triggered angry reactions from the kingdom and its allies. Riyadh has summoned its ambassador to Beirut and expelled the Lebanese envoy. It also banned all Lebanese imports. In a recent interview, the Lebanese minister has branded the Saudi-led war in Yemen as futile and demanded an end to it. Israel plans to build new settler units on occupied Palestinian lands. The decision has drawn condemnation even from the regime's closest allies. During our news review program, we discussed the issue. Let's take a listen.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted to a new Israeli plan to construct more settler units on occupied Palestinian land. Hamas says that Israel's settlement expansion is tantamount to its continued direct war against the Palestinian people. Hamas called on the Palestinian Authority to stop counting on the useless path of reconciliation and instead make Israel recognize Palestinians' rights. Hamas said inclusive and continued resistance against Israel can bring an end to its settlement expansion and free Palestinian land. The new Israeli plan involves the construction of more than 3,000 units in the occupied West Bank, plan has also drawn criticism from a dozen European countries, calling on the regime to immediately reverse its decision. Israel's ally, the U.S., has also expressed a concern. Israel is expanding settlements despite UN resolutions, calling them all illegal and urging a halt to them all. And now joining us for the program is Paul Lurie from the Free Palestine Movement from Berkeley, California, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start off in Kitchener, Ontario there with you, Mr. Robert Fantina. Your initial thoughts on the settlement, more settlement plans by Israeli authorities and all the opposition, and we're really, how far do you think the opposition is going to go to impact Tel Aviv's decision to go ahead with the construction of these settlements?
The opposition will have no impact whatsoever, and that's they're so ironic and so hypocritical. The United States could stop the settlement activity today by simply cutting off all aid to Israel. The United States will not do that. Joe Biden, the president, has said that he will not tie foreign aid to Israel to any of its behaviors, settlement activity, or whatever else it might be. These countries, including the United States, that are expressing concern and voicing opposition, these are meaningless gestures. They need to put some teeth behind these by sanctioning Israel, by ceasing trade, and certainly the United States by ceasing foreign aid. It's pointless to talk about demanding that they stop expressing opposition and so on. That means nothing to the government of Israel. The United States and other countries have been saying this for years, that Israel should stop the settlement activity. There's nothing behind it. Israel continues to do as it pleases, disdain international law, hold human rights in contempt, and these other countries do nothing to stop it.
Thank you there, Robert. And Paul Lurie, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in Berkeley, Paul. Now, if I could, Ned Price in the State Department a couple days ago, I'm sure you heard him up there at the lectern saying that the U.S. is strongly opposed to the construction, and also, what did he say, strongly opposed and strongly rejects, and deeply concerned and strongly opposed. Really strong language. What does it mean, Paul?
Strong language is like strong water, you know. I mean, what is strong water as compared to strong tea or strong coffee? It's nothing. It's empty of everything. This is a charade that has been played. How do we know that it's a charade and that it's insincere? Because every time in the past that these words have come out of government spokespersons, nothing has ever been done. So this is a pure charade. It's for public consumption. It's for image. That's it. Israel is not going to respect what the United States says, and the United States knows that Israel is not going to respect what it says, and Israel knows that the United States knows that it's not going to respect it. So it's nonsense. There's no point to it at all. Israel is going to go ahead and do what it has always done from the beginnings of the Zionist movement, where the housing has been a military strategy. It has been a strategy for taking land. Why do they build settlements on hilltops? There's no water at a hilltop. The water is in the valley. So they build it up there because these are essentially military construction. This is military strategy. This is all they want. They're transferring their population from the territory that they've already conquered, so-called Israel proper, into the occupied territories in order to make those territories into a bigger Israel proper, if you will. The point is to crowd out, to eliminate the Palestinian population where there's still a significant number.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us, and stay safe, both of you. Paul Lurie, professor there, joining us from Berkeley, California, and Robert Fantina, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario, author and journalist.
Anti-French sentiment is running high in Mali, where thousands have come out to protest foreign military presence in the West African country. The demonstrators have flooded the streets of the capital, Bamako, waving national flags and chanting slogans against France. Some of them have set fire to the French flag. They are angry with French interference in Mali's political affairs. They also want a total withdrawal of French troops from their country.
We are here for Mali. We are here to demonstrate our national sovereignty, to remind the whole world that sovereignty belongs to the people, and that today those who have not understood this must update themselves.
France, which is Mali's former colonial ruler, has over 5,000 troops there to help fight the resurgence of extremist groups. But many in Mali consider the mission a failure. Paris now plans to reduce the number of its military personnel in Mali to 3,000. The United Nations Special Representative in Sudan has urged the country's paramilitary forces to avoid confrontation during anti-coup protests scheduled for Saturday. UN envoy made the call during a meeting with Rapid Support Force Chief Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. The capital Khartoum is bracing for major demonstrations on Saturday, following deadly clashes between security forces and protesters. At least 8 people have been killed and 170 others injured over the past days. Paramilitary and army forces have been deployed across Khartoum, as well as the twin cities of Khartoum North and Omdurman. The Sudanese military staged a coup on Monday and declared a state of emergency. The move has drawn international condemnation. Political commentator Julius Maluto says the Sudanese people are fed up with military coups in their country and want a democratic government.
Just like a Sudanese citizen, I can sense the undercurrent of politics there, whereby a lot of people, Sudanese, are yearning for change, and that change means democratic rule. Remember, Sudan has been there. 17 coups have been there in the country, some successful, others not. But it's time since independence of Sudan. It's about time when I think people think they've had enough of military coups. They just don't want it anymore. And I can see tomorrow a lot of determination on the streets of Sudan by the protesters. We are seeing right now a lot of protesters who led the revolution, which was hijacked by the military. Before, of course, the discussions, agreement for transitional government happened. We are seeing them coming back. Iconic figures, even ladies who are leading that revolution, are already, some of them are back, and definitely there will be change, because I see a situation whereby the Sudanese are not relenting. They'll never stop until they get civilian leadership, democratic rule, because that's what they deserve.
Leaders of the world's most advanced nations are arriving in the Italian capital, Rome, to attend the G20 summit. Climate change, health, and the relaunch of the global economy top the agenda of the two-day talks. The participants are under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. The event comes amid protests at inaction to address the problem of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders and global inequality of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatment.
About 4,000 high school students took to the streets of the Italian capital to stage a rally against the upcoming G20 summit of world leaders. Pupils from secondary schools called on the summit's participants to stop the injustices that, quote, have led the planet to the climate crisis and invest significantly in public education as a way to give them a future. The G20 summit will reportedly focus on climate change, health, and the global economic recovery.
We already know for sure that the world leaders will not opt to invest in public health, social welfare, or in fixing the climate crisis. Quite the contrary, their resolutions will be taken in support of banks and large multinationals.
We are here because our school system is on its knees. Public education must be a priority. World leaders must understand it.
Also on Friday, charities Oxfam, Amnesty International and Emergency held a flash mob in Rome's city center demanding world leaders to end global inequality of access to vaccines and coronavirus treatments. According to charities' representatives, billions of people around the world are denied access to COVID vaccine because big pharmas are actively blocking other manufacturers from producing much-needed doses and continue to prioritize selling vaccines to rich countries.
The situation is very serious because in low-income countries at the moment, less than 2% of the population have been fully vaccinated, while in high-income countries, the average is more than 60%.
A large security operation will be enforced with a 10 square kilometer maximum security area in the Eur Quarter, the district surrounding the Congress Center where the G20 summit is taking place. The authorities are wary of the danger that anti-vax extremists and black blocs may pose if they infiltrate the protests. Airspace is closed over Rome and border controls have been enhanced in the attempt to keep away violent protesters.
The G20 summit kicks off on Saturday. Up to 6,000 police officers along with 500 soldiers will be deployed in the Italian capital as authorities fear violent demonstrations during the meeting. Max Civili, Rome.
Thousands of U.S.-bound migrants are advancing slowly in southern Mexico, rejecting an offer to receive provisional visas to stop their journey. The caravan is made up of about 3,000 migrants from Central America and the Caribbean, mostly women and children. They began their journey last week from the southern border of Mexico in a bid to reach the U.S. An advocate for the migrants said that they had been offered to dismantle the caravan in exchange for visas to settle provisionally in Mexico. However, most have rejected the offer. Washington has put pressure on Mexico to contain them before reaching the U.S. border. Previous caravans were confronted by migration agents and soldiers who are increasingly using tough tactics to stem the influx. That does it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September the 2nd, 2021. I always offered a piece of advice to all officials in previous terms. Time passes quickly, and these 4 years will be over very soon. In his very important governmental decree to Malik Ashtar, the commander of the faithful, alayhi salam, considers all these aspects. I advise all you friends to go take a look at it. It says, then, do not keep yourself secluded from the people for a long time. Of course, scholars have put forth other variations and other suggestions for this part. To not seclude oneself. It means that a ruler should not be absent from the people for a long time. Officials cannot, of course, be constantly present among the people. But in some periods of time, they should certainly be present. To not isolate oneself from the people means to not lengthen your absence from the people.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
After expanding on this, the commander of the faithful says, if the subjects suspect you of high-handedness, explain to them your position openly. If there is a doubt in the minds of the people about you, you should present your explanations to them and speak to them openly. Notice that the relationship between the ruler and the people should be like this. This relationship is a brotherly and friendly one, and remove their suspicion with your explanation. Nashul Balagha, letter 53. In other words, if they have a doubt, you should dispel it with your words and your explanations. These were explanations about popularity. Therefore, you should really try to observe these aspects of popularity. Officials in all sectors should have these qualities. The next key word is the administration of justice, which is the basis of the Islamic government and the Islamic Republic. Actually, all religions are based on the administration of justice. God the Exalted says that He sent prophets and heavenly books that people may maintain justice. The Holy Quran, chapter 57, verse 25.
And a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Algeria recently recalled its ambassador to Paris following insulting remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron that disparaged the history of Algeria and its state institutions. The Algerian president has responded to the outburst by Macron and demanded France's total respect for his country. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives an alternative view on events taking place in Africa. This week's edition is focusing on the ongoing tensions between France and Algeria, following insulting remarks by French president against the North African country. In the second segment of our program, we'll talk about how the United States Military Command for Africa is being used by Washington to loot the continent's natural resources in the name of fighting terrorism. Stay with us till the end of the show and send us your comments.
Algeria rejects interference by France. Tensions between France and Algeria have continued to rise following remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron on the North African country's colonial past. Macron reportedly argued that the official history of Algeria has been rewritten not based on truth, but based on hatred against France. He also went on to question if there was an Algerian nation before colonization.
Now, in an interview, the Algerian foreign minister responded to the insulting remarks by Macron.
What was said about Algeria? Algeria had the opportunity to respond to it. We reject any interference in our domestic affairs. We don't accept value judgments on the formation of the Algerian nation. Algerian nation is an old one, deeply rooted in history, a nation that has contributed significantly to the prosperity in the region, in the Mediterranean region, that has cooperated very, very efficiently and substantially with Europe, including France. Algeria has had diplomatic relations with France as well as with a number of other European nations. So we are at ease. All what relates to history, Algeria is a nation like any other nations, and therefore we don't think that it should be subject to any questioning or any debate.
Well, for more on the France-Algeria tensions, we contacted Raouf Farah, an Algerian activist and commentator. He's also the coordinator of Youth Engaged for Algeria and a member of the pro-democracy organization Iptikad. Welcome to our program, sir.
Thank you very much for your invitation.
Now, our first question, why is the French president adopting a confrontational policy towards Algeria at this juncture?
I think we should go beyond also the contextual analysis and interpret Macron's saying as basically what most politicians in France think about the relationship between Algeria and France. And I think Macron's really underestimated the grievances that could create it in France, but also in Algeria. And this is probably one of the reasons why we are here today to discuss that.
Thanks for that, Mr. Farah.
According to some projections, the French president is now under threat from right-wing possible presidential candidate Eric Zemmour. Macron's re-election strategy appears to try to win far-right voters by making the elections not about poverty or economic crisis, but instead about glorifying French colonialism and presenting mostly North African Muslim migrants as the enemy. And all these are linked to a strategy of Islamophobia.
The Algerian foreign minister responds here to speculation that Macron's outbursts are related to the upcoming elections in France.
There are a lot of analysis. I'm not a journalist to enter into a speculative area, but I read what you read, I read what you say as journalist, and I am very much interested in understanding all the situation, and I certainly believe that all of the factors that are being mentioned by the media have certainly their role in the situation and in the crisis which was created. I'm not in a position to assess which of the relevant principles have played a stronger role than the others, but one can intellectually consider that all of them can be relevant in the motivations, but it's not up to me to determine the motivations of a particular person.
Now, do you think there is a link between the insulting remarks by Macron against Algeria and next year's elections in France?
Yes, I think there is definitely a link. The organization of presidential elections in France always brings the question of the tensions relationship between Algeria and France. But I think it's not the only factor one should take when analyzing what Macron has said. I think Macron's decision is really, Macron's saying is really shows what many politicians in France think about the history of the country is in Northern Africa, and they see the adventure of colonialism as, to a certain extent, an enlightenment that brought, to a certain extent, again, civilization to the region.
In another move to protest the patronizing remarks by Macron, Algeria closed its airspace to French military planes. This will complicate military operations by France in the mineral-rich Sahel region where Paris claims is fighting terrorists. Contrary to these claims, it's believed that the French army is in the Sahel to protect the country's economic interests in a region rich in uranium, gold, oil, and other minerals.
Mr. Farah, what's your take on the reaction by Algeria, including closing its airspace for the French military following the remarks by Macron?
One should know that Algeria opened its airspace to the French mission, not Barkhane, but a mission called Serval, which is the ancestor of the Barkhane operation. And since then, the Bouteflika regime from 2013 until his end in 2019 didn't really put an end to that. So I think the Algerian regime took advantage of this very tenuous situation between the two countries to take a step back on what was at that time a controversial decision. And I think after Macron saying it's pretty much normal to see that the Algerian ambassador is called back in his country.
Now, Turkey's foreign minister, Mevlut Cavusoglu, has slammed what he termed as Macron's extremely wrong and populist comments on Turkey and Algeria over colonialism. Now, Macron negatively mentioned Turkey in his anti-Algeria remarks. Is Turkey's increasing influence in many African countries worrying France?
It reflects the sort of leadership competition between Turkey and France when it comes to the Maghreb. And that's not only limits to the economic aspects, but also to the diplomatic aspects, to the geopolitical aspects of this bilateral relation between Algeria and Turkey. Here I have in mind the Libyan question, where Algeria is increasingly involved as one of the most important actors of the region. And Turkey is also pushing Algeria to be on her side on that matter. And France is having a very different position when it comes to the Libyan question. So this is just an example to show that there is clearly a competition between France and Turkey, and Macron's saying are immediately related to that.
Some analysts believe what is happening between Algeria and France is inseparable from the severing of relations between Algeria and neighboring Morocco, which normalized ties with the Israeli regime and betrayed the Palestinians. Is France pressurizing Algeria on behalf of the Israeli regime due to the move by Algiers to block the regime's observer status in the African Union?
I think Algeria will continue to defend the Palestinian voice within the international fora, including the African Union. And when there will be a chance to listen an increasing impact of Israel on the continent, it will do so. One of the triggers of the tensions between Algeria and Morocco, because Algeria has also cut its diplomatic ties with Morocco, is the normalization of Morocco's relationship with Israel after the signatory of the Abraham agreements. So all these factors are interrelated. And I don't see French pushing in particular for this agenda because they know that, overwhelmingly speaking, the Algerian regime remains against anything that comes from Israel.
The Algerian foreign minister says he is optimistic that the current crisis with France will also be resolved in the future. Let's take a listen.
We have no doubt that the current crisis will be solved in the future, at any given time in the future, bearing in mind and taking into account all the principles, all the interests of the Algerian side.
Now, last question. Should we expect further escalation between France and Algeria in future?
point in this bilateral crisis between France and Algeria. So I don't think that it will go further deep, but the consequences of this crisis remain relatively inconsumable, in the sense that we don't know the full consequences of that. I think that it won't be limited to the military and to the recalling of the ambassador. There might be also other decisions taken, but these are I would say indirect consequences rather than direct decisions taken by the Algerian regime against France.
Well, thank you, Rauf, Algerian activist and commentator, for your insight on the current standoff between France and Algeria. Let's now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on the activities of the United States Military Command for Africa. Stay with us.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
In 2008, the United States Military Command for Africa, known as AFRICOM, was established and is currently headquartered in Germany. The formation of AFRICOM was followed by a new scramble for Africa, including plans by the U.S. to expand and strengthen its hegemony in this continent.
The U.S. claims that AFRICOM operations in Africa are about counterterrorism. However, since the establishment of this U.S. command, Africa has seen a massive increase in incidents of violence attributed to Takfiri terrorist groups. As if that is not enough, U.S. forces in Africa have killed many civilians while terrorists roam freely across the continent. An investigation by Amnesty International has revealed that the U.S. killed innocent civilians during an airstrike inside Somalia instead of hitting Al-Shabaab terrorists. Amnesty says such indiscriminate attacks in which civilians are killed or injured can constitute war crimes.
Targeting individuals who are not directly participating in active hostilities, indiscriminately attacking them and killing them, amounts to, you know, a breach of international humanitarian law, and that can amount to war crimes.
And to discuss more about U.S. military presence in Africa, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, a coordinator for the U.S. Out of Africa Network and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first question, what do you think were the secret objectives of the U.S. government when it formed its military command for Africa?
Well, the purpose of AFRICOM is to use U.S. military power to impose U.S. control of African land, resources, and labor to service the needs of U.S. multinational corporations and the wealthy in the United States. And U.S. military presence in Africa didn't begin with AFRICOM, but AFRICOM now formalizes that presence with better coordination and strategic focus for realizing the long-term geopolitical goals of U.S. imperialism in Africa, which includes beating out China and others in the battle for power and influence on the continent. Another objective is the long-standing effort to prevent the emergence of any independent African influence or force. And the war report in the DRC is an illustrative example. The US initially worked with Belgium to assassinate the first prime minister of the newly independent Democratic Republic of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba, because of the threat his leadership posed to US and Western control of strategic raw materials in the DRC. AFRICOM brings this effort into the present day through military might.
The US has fully militarized its so-called war on terror in Africa. Many security experts in Africa disagree with this approach dictated by the US, as it has only increased terrorism. Despite AFRICOM announcing that it's in Africa to combat terrorism, we have since seen a rapid increase of terrorism. What could be the reason behind this?
AFRICOM isn't in Africa to fight terrorism, and the US military presence is a destabilizing presence. Terrorism is actually a useful pretext for the US to assert its power. In that sense, AFRICOM has been a success. The United States has vastly expanded its power and influence on the continent through AFRICOM as it vies for full spectrum global dominance in the competition with folks like China and Russia. If the goal is to fight and end terrorism, AFRICOM is a woeful failure, as you've shared. The number of incidents of violence attributed to terrorist organizations have increased fivefold since AFRICOM was established 13 years ago. But ending terrorism is not the goal. Terrorism is a byproduct of imperialism, and claims of fighting against it are used for public relations purposes. Ending terrorism and liberating Africa from the clutches of U.S. imperialism means shutting down AFRICOM and removing all U.S. forces from the continent and the world.
Many innocent civilians, including women and children, have been killed during U.S. airstrikes in Somalia. AFRICOM arrogantly stated that it had not paid any compensation in Somalia for civilian casualties it had acknowledged since 2017.
Now, civilians have borne the brunt of AFRICOM operations in Africa, especially in countries such as Somalia, where the U.S. refuses to compensate the victims. Clearly, AFRICOM does not value the lives of African people. What's your take on this?
The lives of millions of African people are simply bargaining chips that are played by the United States in the new scramble of Africa, which is similar to what took place in the 1880s when the colonial powers fought over which of them would dominate which parts of the resource-rich continent. In Somalia specifically, AFRICOM has caused the murder of thousands and the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people. For AFRICOM, what matters more than black or African lives is what Vice Admiral Robert Mueller, former AFRICOM deputy, admitted is protecting the free flow of natural resources from Africa to the global market. The U.S. has also used the framework of enemy combatants to decide that a victim is an enemy without having to provide any proof. This allows them to ignore the suffering of countless civilian victims and their quest for compensation, all in pursuit of U.S. interests.
Now, Mali and Guinea are two mineral-rich West African countries that saw military takeovers this year. The coup leaders in both countries claimed that they want to put an end to corruption and human rights abuses. But the military officers who led the coups in Mali and Guinea had close links to the United States and France, and these has raised suspicions about other motives behind these military takeovers.
In 2018, thousands of people in Ghana rallied in their capital, Accra, to protest a deal that would have given the United States military an expanded role in the country. A politician from Ghana speaks here during a protest march against U.S. military presence in his country.
If you allow for a permanent U.S. military presence in our country, we have seen where everywhere there has been permanent U.S. military presence, what it has attracted. It has attracted terrorism, it has attracted destabilization, and we don't want Ghana to be destabilized. We also say that this agreement is lopsided, it's one-sided, there's nothing in it for Ghana apart from the dangers.
Following the protests, the president of Ghana, Nana Akufo-Addo, categorically rejected claims that the United States will set up a military base in the country.
Let me state with the clearest affirmation that Ghana has not offered a military base and will not offer a military base to the United States of America.
Now, clearly, many people in Africa are opposed to the presence of U.S. forces in this continent. Now, will all the leaders listen to the people and demand complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from Africa?
Well, imperialism is a global system that requires the enforcement of certain conditions, and that's exactly why autocratic leaders are supported by the West and Western imperialist projects. These governments are the neocolonial political cover for the West's control of the land, labor, and markets of the colonized. So though many people in Africa are opposed to the presence of U.S. forces in their countries, a mass or a popular movement is needed to demilitarize and depose imperialism and militarism on the continent. And that really requires the construction of a mass-based geostrategic vision that prioritizes the removal of AFRICOM and other European military projects. That's why the demands of the U.S. Out of Africa campaign include the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Africa, the demilitarization of the African continent, and the closure of U.S. bases throughout the world. And that's crucial in this effort.
Well, there you have it. A mass movement is needed to eject U.S.-led imperialist forces in Africa. Thanks a lot, Mr. Tunde Osazua, for your insight. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. God bless you all.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is Foresight. program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's tip, what are the secrets of the Salik's humility, the humility of the spiritual wayfarer, and our ubudiyya, our servitude to Allah?
Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So dear listeners, when we're talking about the secrets of the Salik, the spiritual wayfarer, we've talked about in some programs that we have to have some sense of humility and humbleness within our servitude to Allah, our ubudiyya to Allah. Now, here we know that there are, for the people of Sayr al-Suluk, for the people of spiritual wayfaring, and of course, as we have said in various programs, that the spiritual wayfaring, this suluk fillah, this travel, this spiritual journey towards Allah, is in reality our ubudiyya, our servitude of Allah, our worship of Allah. Now, we know, of course, that the people of spiritual wayfaring, when it comes to this station of humility and of servitude to Allah and the ubudiyya to Allah, there are, of course, within this one idea or this concept of humility, there are various stations, there's countless stages and degrees. And so, for example, you know, there is a primary stage of humility, and as this spiritual wayfarer, as this salik, this person on this journey, in order to perfect and complete their ubudiyya, perfect their servitude to Allah, we find that the higher they go, the more perfect their humility becomes. Now, of course, being humble in our prayers, having humility in the presence of Allah is something that is critical, and it is a very important pillar if we want to increase and strengthen our ubudiyya. Now, of course, we find that even great spiritual masters such as Imam Ruhullah Khomeini, the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, we find that even great spiritual masters such as himself, they will write that comprehensively knowing all the aspects of one factor, such as humility, when it comes to the perfection of ubudiyya, and counting all the stages within this one factor, such as humility, is really beyond the capacity of any humble creature. And as it is said in the traditions, the ways to Allah are as numerous as the breaths of the creatures. And so, likewise, the stages of humility are countless, but the important thing is that on our path towards perfecting our ubudiyya to Allah, we should consistently and constantly strive to be better and purer in our path.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com. Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Khaifin, the whispered prayer of the fearful. Please stay with me. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, what thinkest you? Will you chastise me after my faith in you? Drive me far away after my love for you? Deprive me while I hope for your mercy and forgiveness? Forsake me while I seek sanctuary in your pardon? How could your generous face disappoint me? I wish that I know. Did my mother bear me for wretchedness? Did she nurture me for suffering? If such, then I wish that she had not borne me and had not nurtured me. I wish that I had knowledge. Have you appointed me one of the people of felicity? Have you singled me out for your nearness and neighborhood? Then would my eyes be gladdened, and in that my soul reach serenity.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In continuation to what we were saying, which was regarding the spiritual wayfarer, and one of these ideas or concepts, or for example, stations, which is very important when it comes to our ubudiyya to Allah, our servitude and our worship to Allah, we find that humility plays a critical and integral role. Now, along with humility, we will find that knowledge comes, and when knowledge comes by the grace and blessings of Allah, we hope and pray that wisdom comes as well. Now, along with humility, one of the stages and one of these ideas which is critical and integral when it comes to our ubudiyya, our servitude, and our worship to Allah, we find that the stage of knowledge is very important. And so in Arabic, it is known as ilm, knowledge. Now, the stage of knowledge and the importance of knowledge is such that it proves at times, and usually actually, by scientific conduct and by philosophical and logical argument, it proves the humility of servitude and the need, of humility in servitude. And it also proves by scientific conduct, by philosophical argument, by logical and reasonable argument, it proves that the glory of Allah should be worshipped, it should be revered, it should be esteemed, and all of this should be done with humility. Now, this knowledge